Welcome to the Autism Roundtable. I'm Leah Gross, founder of Circle Care Services. I'll bring you autism experts from all kinds of fields for helpful parenting ideas, insights, and strategies. Tune in for learning and support and connection. Welcome, Matt, to the Autism Roundtable. Thank you so much for joining us today. You come with many hats in the autism community. Can you please introduce yourself and tell us all about your personal background and your professional background?
Thank you so much, Lee, for having me. So my name is Matthew Lunsford. I am a board certified and licensed behavior analyst in the state of Virginia, licensed special education teacher, supervisee in clinical social work, yoga therapist, yoga teacher, yoga grandmaster, and assistive technology professional. I hold an MSW in clinical social work and two other master's degrees in special education and psychology. And I'm currently working on my Doctor of Social Work at the University of Kentucky.
What motivated you to go for all these different degrees?
Partially necessity and partially wanting to offer comprehensive care to my patients. So I am legally blind, hard of hearing, and have cerebral palsy. So when I first started my journey in academia and trying to become a licensed healthcare professional, the state barred individuals with disabilities from accessing most licensed professions. Here in Virginia, law still states that if your visual acuity is worse than 20/40, you cannot legally work in a profession where you're touching another human being. So that narrowed things down to psychology and behavior. And I settled on behavior analysis while going through my MED. I didn't know that the field existed prior to studying special ed, but it was love at first sight for me, and I rolled with it and quickly set up my private practice.
Wow, you've accomplished so much. Let me hear a little bit about the obstacles that you faced in getting there, being that you do come with some disabilities. Tell us what were the roadblocks for you and what kept you going to keep through this journey?
Primarily systemic discrimination. In person, I am obviously disabled, so I have a white cane and use hearing aids when I'm not using AirPods. And I noticed that when I was interviewing for residency spots, the interview would go well, but I'd always get rejected for sometimes it'd be some stupid reason. You could tell they were fishing for a reason to not hire me. Couple of times, one was flat out, they did not want to accommodate me, and they said so. And a few other times were me not having a driver's license. So they expected residents to be able to get to the residency site with their own transportation. I don't know if you're an active Lyft or Uber user, but it adds up very quickly when it's your primary form of transportation.
Wow. And you made it to the other end. So what, and you have a successful practice and you're doing, so much good in the world of autism. What advice can you give to somebody that might be going through the system and sort of facing the same challenges of discrimination? Are there any key points that you found helpful in navigating that world?
So first and foremost, I always tell anyone else with a disability going through the process of residency or even practicum to never give up, first and foremost. You will always find the right practice, supervisor, what have you, eventually. And two, know your rights. I find that many individuals with disabilities do not know the law all that well, and they end up thinking that XYZ is legal and is in fact discrimination, and they have legal recourse. I personally made extensive use of the Virginia Department for the Blind and Vision Impaired. One of the perks of legal blindness is free college through a vocational rehab, and that comes with access to a certified vocational rehabilitation counselor. And in the case of myself, a teacher for the blind and vision impaired, they were great advocates. When I was going through special ed school, for example, the sped department chair, we found out she hid my passing praxis results, and those needed to be in by a certain date for us to go on to practicum. And my vocational counselor had to call her personally, threatened to sue. That didn't work. So they escalated to the Department of the Blind, sending a what it was described to me as a nasty letter to the university threatening to sue them if they did not magically locate my passing scores, which I had submitted.
That's so disappointing, especially like how many years ago was this?
Let's see, I went through my MED 2018 through, and I graduated in December 2020. So this was right in the middle of just before COVID.
You would hope that in today's day and age that it wouldn't be so difficult and people wouldn't put so many obstacles. So I guess what we learned from your story is that the world is still hard to navigate, and you do need to really make sure that you stand up for your rights and use legal action. That's good that you use the resources that you had. If someone like was reaching out in their state for help, where would you tell them to like turn first?
If it's a legal matter, first and foremost, seek out counsel from your state's disability law center. Here in Virginia, we have, well, the Disability Law Center, and it is an organization that offers pro bono legal counsel to individuals with disabilities meeting certain criteria, which I don't know what those are off the top of my head, but they're great just for having a chat about your situation, and they'll tell you if something can be solved through like advocacy on their part, or if you need to escalate to filing like an EEOC complaint, Department of Justice complaint, or flat out suing.
Okay, so thanks for sharing that. Now, tell us a little bit about your social work practice that you're working in now, how you got there, and what things you love in the field of social work.
So my practice primarily focuses on working with neurodivergent individuals with anxiety disorders. I also specialize in working with pediatric and adult gender dysphoria, and working with individuals that are adjusting to acquired disability. So, like, just as an example, I have an individual in co who's a college student that was recently diagnosed with a chronic illness. So we're working on making that adjustment to being able-bodied and now having to worry about fatigue and how to adapt to a changing lifestyle. When, of course, her mind is, I want to go, 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 because I'm still young, but her body is protesting.
Wow. And what kind of things do you tell her? How do you work with an individual like that?
This is where I combine behavior analysis and psychotherapy. So what I would do, someone in a similar situation, would be to figure out the call the function of their behavior for what they're trying to do. So let's say, just for example, complete hypothetical. Let's say someone with a back issue wanted to ride roller coasters, right? And they want that thrill, that sensory seeking behavior. So what I would do in a case like that is explore other avenues for them to engage in similar activities that won't make harm their back or be contraindicated.
Wow. Okay, that must be a creative job.
Yes, I have m more often than not, I'm coming up with very outside of the box solutions.
Wow. Okay, wait. So you said first, one of the things that you said is you help people acclimate to a new diagnosis. What was the other two that you had said that you're working with?
Predominantly individuals with anxiety disorders, so phobias, OCD, generalized anxiety disorder, and pediatric and adult gender dysphoria.
Okay, let's first address the anxiety. So tell me a little bit about what practice looks like for individuals that you're working on phobias or anxiety. What kind of presentation is it, and what kind of treatment are you providing?
So, generalized anxiety disorder is your classic, what everyone thinks of when they think of anxiety. So, persistent worry, the what if, what if, what if, and fear of, it can be fear of going out into the community, fear of public speaking. It's a very, we're casting a wide net. So, what I would do generally is help the person process their emotions. I use a combination of CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, and psychodynamic therapy, because I firmly believe that anxiety is rooted in past events. So, it could be some childhood trauma, you could narrow it down to one bad experience, but there's something going on in the past that needs to be processed because you're not just born with anxiety. It's a learned behavior. With CBT, we work on challenging those thoughts and recognizing what may or may not be illogical, and look at other ways of exploring an event that may have happened. So, if you came to me and said, "So and so was rude to me," I might say, "Okay, what's the scenario?" And I might say, "Okay, so and so was having a rough day and might have been crabby, or so and so is stressed, and you might want to revisit talking to them about XYZ later on." And after a few rounds of doing that, they start to learn that, okay, not everything is this black and white thinking that my anxiety is telling me.
Is it adults you're working with or pediatrics?
I work across the lifespan, but the bulk of my patients are within the adult demographic.
Adult demographics. Like, what are you finding with medication for anxiety? Do you find that it's a crutch? It's helpful. Everyone's individual and different. Like, what do you find as far as needing to refer out for medication?
So I'm not anti-medication by any means. I fully understand that sometimes there's no other option for people. But I have found with anxiety, there is an extremely high potential for abuse and addiction. So I'm not one to refer out unless A, the case is so extreme, the person cannot leave their home, or B, we have tried literally everything in my toolbox with no relief. And in that case, I'd refer out to psychiatry. To use medication as an adjunct treatment, because the way psychotropics are supposed to be used in most cases is to help facilitate therapy. So if you're going to a good psychiatrist and you're not displaying something like, let's say, schizophrenia or some other form of psychosis, what should be done is the psychiatrist will monitor the medication, you attend therapy, and as you progress with the aid of the medication is slowly titrated downward, and you're able to go out without the aid of medication. And that's the textbook perfect scenario. We don't always see that, but that's generally the route I like to go in most cases.
Yeah, and I feel like, I don't know, I feel like since COVID, I'm a practitioner as well, occupational therapist, and I feel like I was in practice for 15 years, and I would say around 2020, I felt like started seeing such an increase in anxiety in patients and clients that we're just seeing so much of it today. Growing up, I don't feel like every next person had anxiety, but today we're seeing so much of it. Any theories on what's going on in the world and what's causing all of this anxiety?
So I primarily blame a combination of technology and our capitalist culture. I found that most individuals who work a traditional 9-to-5, it's or akin to slave labor. Like, I see cases where the boss has been like, oh yeah, so I need you to stay an extra 2 hours to work on this project, or they give these crazy deadlines. And that in turn leads to fear of being, fired, and you end up in this constant cycle of rush, 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 with no chance to unwind and enjoy life. And you spend the bulk of your adult life and even teenage years sometimes in this capitalist corporate culture. So you go 35 plus years of working, and then you have what, 20, 30 more years left in retirement on average. So you end up exhausted. I have also noticed a huge spike in technology addiction within, especially the younger demographic. Like with Apple Watches, you constantly get the text, and you're like, oh, let me go see what this person wants, or let me go see what this notification is. So you don't get to live in the here and now and really live.
Right, we're always like on to the next thing. We're not here today and now. So what kind of like solutions do you give to your clients to sort of combat these things?
So I use a lot of what we call stimulus deltas in behavior analysis. So for my individuals who are addicted to technology, I treat it like an addiction. So I will often have them go into like parental controls or accessibility, and put in like set limits for the apps they're more likely to use. Like I've seen a lot of Instagram dependence. So what I will have them do is go in and limit access to Instagram for, let's say, 9 to 10 in the morning. And after that, I expect them to like go out and just do things. So like go take a walk out in nature, go downtown and grab a coffee with a friend. Basically anything that'll get them away from the tech and yet still be reinforcing for them.
What do you think individuals today are getting from tech that it makes it so addictive?
That's that instantaneous reinforcement. Pre-tech, when pre-Facebook even, when it was just emails and the like, we didn't get instant reinforcement. We weren't on a fixed an F1 schedule. Instead, it was okay, your friend could email you and you'd get to it whenever you could get to it. But with the advent of smartphones and social media, that has changed. We now get these instantaneous notifications, and there's a larger like societal expectation that you'll respond instantaneously and constantly be available, which is not the case for 99% of people.
Right. It definitely puts a big pressure on us, I guess, hence the anxiety. Oh, that's really amazing that you change lives and you're really there to support people through difficult times. So, wow, kudos to you. When we spoke last, you told me a little bit about your dissertation that you were writing. Could you share with us what it is and what you found when doing your research?
Sure. So my dissertation is on exploring and identifying the existence of neurodivergent culture. My preliminary research has found that there are anthropological signs of unique aspects of culture that are unique to the neurodivergent community. Like, for example, music and theater. We're finding that within the neurodivergent community, there are unique musical compositions and styles of music that are not found being produced by neurotypical individuals. Same goes for like the dramatic arts or writing. We're finding motifs within those art forms that we're not seeing in the neurotypical community. So my research is broadly exploring what those cultural practices are. So I'm looking at things like how do neurodivergent people greet each other? What are gift-giving practices? What are some unique aspects for like holidays? And really honing in on how this is differentiated from neurotypical individuals. And from once that is done, I plan to either A, publish this as a book for the general population, or start exploring how this cultural knowledge can be applied to behavior analysis and psychotherapy to improve clinical outcomes and clinical practice as a whole.
Do you feel like the neurodivergent population has enough like collaboration or networking where individuals feel like I found my home, I have a group of people that I share interests with, and I have a way of expressing it? Are there outlets for neurodiverse individuals that want to be with other neurodiverse individuals?
So I'm neurodivergent myself, and one unique aspect of the community is that we tend to find each other. So, like, all of my personal friends are neurodivergent. I can only think of maybe one person who's neurotypical, and I've noticed that within our own little friend groups, we have very unique ways of like self-expression. So, like, I've got a good friend of mine back from like high school. We have an Instagram chat going, and we express ourselves through sending like Instagram reels. So she'll send me like five, six, seven, or eight reels to express like what she's feeling or what she wants to show me, and I'll reciprocate with a barrage of Instagram reels. And we very rarely actually have back and forth conversation. For us, the reels work,
They're a way of
and.
expressing yourself. You don't need your words. You understand the emotion and the feeling behind it.
Right, like we can pick up on exactly what we're trying to express to each other through the reels, and it we've also found it helps with our attention span. So instead of getting like a barrage of text, we can just go, oh, this is what they're talking about. This is what they want to say.
So you think people just find each other? You don't think that there's a ne like a need for a network of any sort, or are there already networks out there?
There are some networks, like for example, there's a neurodivergent only dating app called Haiki, I believe it's how you pronounce it. But I do think having more explicit networks and more explicit communities for just the neurodivergent individuals, even those who just identify as neurodivergent and don't want to go through the formal diagnostic process, would be beneficial. So I've noticed with most of my neurodivergent patients, one of the biggest complaints is the best word, is that there are not enough neurodivergent spaces, and interacting with neurotypical people facilitates masking, and we now know that masking is traumatizing and harmful. So having dedicated spaces where people know they can fully unmask and not be judged, shunned, what have you, would be highly beneficial.
Are there like is A, is there literature out there, and B, are there spaces for people for neurodivergent individuals to unmask?
So the re some of the preliminary research I've done has found that masking is physiologically harmful to the brain. So most individuals, well, all individuals of autism have far more neurological connections than a neurotypical person. So in a neurotypical person, there's a process called synaptic pruning in which the brain will naturally cut unused connections and within the brain, but in a neurodivergent individual, that process either just one does not occur at all, or occurs in a limited way. So those neurological connections are all still there. So when they try to suppress the need to like stem for self-regulation, that in turn causes physiological harm to the brain. So to address your other question, I do not think there are enough spaces at all. There need to be more explicit.
Okay, wait, go back to the stimming for 1 minute. So, I like that you brought up that topic. So, what is your thoughts on that? Like, how should an individual address that? Is it important for them to look typical within a society, or should they just go out stimming, or should they replace that behavior? What are your thoughts on these kind
So,
of odd, like you're saying, not to mask, which I definitely hear how it could have negative effects, but then how could they feel comfortable going out, or or should they just fly free? Like, what's your thoughts?
So, assuming the sting is not harmful, so not a form of like self-injury. So like if an individual engaged in like scratching themselves as a stem to the point where it drew blood, then that is something that would need to be clinically addressed, and I would personally make sure we found a replacement stem that gave the same biological feedback. But I firmly believe that an individual should be able to like stem freely and to be able to self-regulate their nervous system. I have, speaking broadly, I have found that the neurotypical community generally seems to find anything that is different, whether it be stimming, info dumping, special interests, odd, and we like, and society as a whole likes to ostracize anyone or anything that's odd. So I do, there needs to be broader acceptance, and I do believe that autistic individuals or anyone who's neurodivergent should be able to stim freely. What I do for individuals who are, like, say, late diagnosed, newly diagnosed, or they want to explore other ways to stim in public, I will identify what their like primary stim is. So let's say it's something like pulling on their shirt, right? And I get that input from fabric. We might look at something like carrying around a little sample of their preferred texture, and they can keep it in their pocket when they need to stim. Or I have another individual that will go to like a preferred clothing store and just act like she's browsing, and she'll like feel the shirts, the dresses, to get that sensory input. So there are alternatives, but if I had like a magic wand, I would make society accepting enough to where individuals could just stim freely, and it would not be a problem.
I like the perspective, and I like the idea of also providing other stims that might be more, socially accepted. I love the idea that everyone should accept everybody, but I guess if we're putting everyone in society together, I've had the experience with clients of mine who felt bad about themselves that they were doing things that no one else in their class was doing. So I think that also could sort of have an effect. Like when you're living in a world with people that are not doing the same thing as you, a lot of times children will voice that they know that they're different. Have you come across that?
Yes, both children and late diagnosed adults have noticed there is, like you said, they know they're different. Most, honestly, almost every child with a disability will reach a point where they realize, hey, I'm not like my peers. So what I would do in a case like that is explore that identity. We do a deep dive into self-acceptance, and I'm a firm believer in psychoeducation, regardless of age. So what I've done with my, I have a pediatric patient who diagnosed with ADHD, and what we've done is we've sat down and I dumb it down, for lack of a better term, what's going on in the brain, how his brain is different, but also how that makes him unique and gives him a unique perspective, and how we can like leverage that diagnosis to his advantage. He calls it his ADHD superpower now. So we made tremendous progress
You
there,
made
and
progress. Yay,
yeah.
exactly. And that is, I think, so beautiful. If we could have children taking their differences and making them into superpowers and realizing how they could use it for good and find the right way to sort of challenge chal sorry to channel their differences to be, a help to society and even contributing to society. Like, look, Matthew, you're someone pretty amazing with so many differences and disabilities, and you're giving back to society. So if we could empower all children to see their disability as something to give back and to make progress in the world and help others, that would be absolute amazing superpowers.
Like, there are many ways I could change perspective on disability. Just as an example, I worked with visually impaired children in the past, and of course they're upset because they need like large print and audiobooks. But I'll point out, you know, if you learn Braille, you can read in the dark. A sighted person cannot read in darkness, whereas a blind person, we can just pull out a book in Braille and away we go.
Wow. And that's also a big piece in perspective taking, which sounds like that's a lot of what you do, is sort of figure out how to make the situation a positive situation instead of looking at what we don't have, looking at what we do have and how we can sort of, you know, really make that amazing. I love that idea with the Braille in the dark.
That's essentially amazing. My approach, you know, find what the person can do, not what they can't do.
Wow. Tell us a little bit about your vision diagnosis and what like different obstacles you bumped into as a child and what took you through it.
So I have a condition called retinopathy of prematurity. I was born three months premature. So what ROP is underdeveloped and partially detached retina. What happens in the back of the eye during development, so you have a great deal of vasculature, which is veins and blood supply. In a normal individual, the unneeded vasculature will essentially recede, right? Because it's needed for development. In ROP, that does not recede. And what happens is it essentially pries the retina away from the back of the eye. It is a five-stage condition. Stages 1 and 2 can easily be reversed, or they reverse it. It reverses on its own, depending on the situation. Stages 3 and 4 are partially detached retina, and that's where I'm at. Like, one eye is stage 4, so in that eye, my retina is literally just floating back and forth. Stage 5 is total retinal detachment, so blindness. So my upbringing was a unique one. I had an eye doctor who did not believe in diagnosing legal blindness in children. So I went undiagnosed until my college years, top of the visual, retinal issues. I have very limited peripheral vision, so I can't see anything off to my sides. Growing up, I was denied access to Braille by the school system, denied access to white cane training. So I went through school holding books, papers, et cetera, literally an inch from my face until I got to high school. And the Department for the Blind got involved and started advocating for me. You know, finally learned to use a white cane, junior year of college.
Wow. That's rough that they didn't want to give you a diagnosis.
So what's interesting in Virginia, each school district is allowed to acknowledge which disabilities it will and will not permit in the school system. So they decided that it was physiologically impossible for a child to be blind or have low vision. So that's what the school board voted on. So blind children did not exist.
Wow, that's really pretty amazing. In today's day and age, are they still doing that?
Depends on the district. I saw one recently where they did not acknowledge deaf or hard of hearing students, which I don't agree with whatsoever.
In that experience that you went through, what pieces do you wish were different? And like for a parent that might be struggling with a child that is visually impaired, what sort of advice would you wish that parent would know?
I would first of all go back to the advocacy component. I'd also strongly recommend getting that child into therapy, ideally with a blind or visually impaired therapist as soon as humanly possible. That way they can start working on the emotions that are coming up. So the longer you go with having to pretend to be sighted, the worst it's going to get for you psychologically. And then you're into adulthood and it's like, okay, I've got this identity. I never got the support I needed as a child. Yet now what? And the parents, unfortunately, also need to get a realistic understanding of what that child's life is going to be like in the future. Like my parents, they never told me, or they never told I would never be able to drive. So my eye doctor was like, "Yeah, give it a shot." I'll just say I crashed the car twice. I had no business driving. I should not have been driving. Never again. But I
Ever.
wish someone had sat me down and gone like point blank, you're blind at the bat. You should not be doing this for your own safety. Get it out of your system and let's look at some other ways for you to safely get around.
Yeah, there must be a huge emotional component with that. Like, not being able to do things that others can do and coming to the acceptance of that. Like, every teenager wants to drive a car and, go fast on the highway and drive the convertible. So what advice might you give to a parent that's that has a child that is going through accepting their disability? What kind of work do you do with children to help them accept it?
So in the case of a blind or visually impaired teenager, I would be start looking at alternatives for transportation. That way, that can, one, they won't feel so, housebound or unable to go out into the community. But I would also, start emphasizing, that everyone's different. Not everyone's pathway in life is the same. There's different ways to get to where you want to go in life, and that does not always involve having a car or really anything that a typical person would have. We don't all drive. We don't all take the train. Everyone's different.
Do you find that that individuals that you're working with do have a hard time accepting it, and have like emotional push to their disability?
It really depends on the person, but I see most of the pushback with my teenage patients. Like I get it. In the teenage years, you want to be a little rebellious. You don't want to listen to parents, teachers, therapists. You think you know it all. But for those individuals, I share my story openly, and you don't. You might want to drive, but you also don't want to crash the car. We explore safety and the fact that they're not invincible. So you stick a blind or visually impaired teenager behind the car, or behind the wheel of a car. We need to explore the idea that, okay, you could very easily crash into a tree. You could go into the other lane and hit someone head on. The possibilities for danger and death are numerous, even for a sighted person. So that's magnified even more for someone who's visually impaired.
Yes, that I like that component that you bring the whole safety in, and I guess we all have limitations of what we can and we can't do. And I'm sure, like, for parents as well, like, just being understanding and being with the children in the struggle is a component as well.
Oh, yes. For parents, I always tell them, be there for your child as much as you can. And first and foremost, educate yourself, make sure you're knowledgeable. And I am a firm believer in giving as many resources as I can. So I will connect them to the Department for the Blind. If someone is, let's say, deaf blind, then I connect them to the deaf blind, just department division. In Virginia, it's a sub deaf blind is a subcategory of the Department for the Blind rather than Department of the Hearing, but that's neither here nor there. It's just how things are organized.
Wow. Is it common that you see individuals that have deafness and blindness?
It's extremely rare. I've only met
Interesting.
one individual in 4 years of clinical practice.
Tell us a little bit about the deafness diagnosis, what it's about, how it impacted you, and what sort of accommodations were helpful.
So I was diagnosed with mild sensory neural hearing loss like 2 or 3 years ago. I've been a hearing aid user ever since, and I have found that my primary accommodations have been making sure I'm like directly facing the individual, and for like video chatting, I have my like AirPods tuned to my audiogram. So with AirPods, they can act as like hearing aids since depending on your hearing loss. So they're tuned to enhance my hearing, just like my hearing aids are. I personally prefer the hearing aids, far better quality, but it is what it is.
Were you ever embarrassed or worried about the way it looked?
So hearing aids nowadays are pretty much invisible. When they prescribe them, they try to blend it in with your hair color. So my hearing aids are chestnut, so that you can't even tell I'm wearing it unless you know what you're looking for.
Does it come with any annoyances like ringing? Was there any accommodation that you needed in getting them, or you just needed it so badly you were so happy to stick them in?
I was mostly ha happy to stick them in. The first month is literally the worst. So much itching. Imagine having headphones in your ears 24, almost 24/7. After a while, it's going to start to itch horribly. But that's probably the biggest hurdle I had. Besides, like getting adjusted to actually hearing everything as it should be again. But that's unfortunately, no hearing aid can restore hearing, like to normal levels of hearing. But the modern tech does a very, very good job.
You've come through so much and you really've dealt with a lot. Okay, last thing before we move on to all the yoga techniques that I want to hear about. Okay, you mentioned also having cerebral palsy, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, tell us a little bit about that diagnosis, what's involved, and maybe what supports might be out there.
So cerebral palsy, for anyone who does not know, is essentially brain damage to the motor cortex. There's multiple types, spastic ataxic and diplegic. Then you get into the subtypes affecting individual limbs, two limbs, one limb, except so on and so forth. but in my case, my right leg is shorter than the other, so I walk with a very pronounced limp. I have some speech issues. I occasionally stutter, occasionally slur my words if I'm extremely stressed. In my case, that's about, well, I also have some difficulty with fine motor skills. So, like, if you ask me to, let's say, chop an onion, I'm going to have physical difficulty as the pieces get smaller and smaller. So, like, at least in the kitchen, I use a great deal of adapted equipment. So, like, mandolins, for example, for slicing onions or tomatoes. I'm a huge fan of crock pots and basically anything that saves me from having to do, like, more fine motor task. But I have something like pancakes, for example, I've gotten better with practice, although I don't always get the pancake into the pan when I'm flipping them, but that's a work in progress.
I don't flip pancakes and I don't have any fine motor issues. The Betty Crocker is really good, and then you just flip it over, try it.
Sounds like gonna make my life much easier.
Yeah, I make the batter and then you put it in the Betty Crocker and then you flip it with a spatula. And I never was able to flip pancakes.
I don't know how anyone does it, quite frankly.
But there's always accommodations, I guess. Tell us a little bit about the therapies you went through and what you felt was helpful in accommodating your gross motor, your fine motor.
So I spent from, say, preschool through 5th grade in speech therapy. I'd say it was successful for the most part. I said I still stutter from time to time, but I'm much better than I was as a child. As a child, I could barely, speak clearly or fluently.
Are there certain things that you tell yourself in your head still till today from therapy, that help you speak clearly? Because I haven't heard you stutter.
So like I can tell when I'm going to stutter, so I know to take a pause and before I start trying to speak again, if I'm getting stuck on a word that I or sound that I know I have trouble with, I very quickly in my head circumnavigate that and change my vocabulary, and basically little things like that. As for OT, I was an OT from pretty much birth through, I want to say, sixth or seventh grade. The primary focus in OT was on perfecting fine motor skills, specifically my handwriting. My handwriting was pretty much illegible until like fifth grade. Nowadays, I mostly type.
I was getting ready to say I'm an occupational therapist, and by the time fifth grade comes, if you're not writing, you're typing. I would prefer to see you actually be able to get what's in your head out onto the computer than really work that hard on writing.
Yeah, like my OT basically gave up on perfecting my handwriting when I hit fifth grade. He's like, okay, here's a computer. We're going to teach you to type.
Yes. Yeah. And I do think that's a big piece. It's remembering that there are other ways. There's not only one way.
Yes, that's what I love about OT. There's, more than one way to accommodate something. We don't necessarily need to keep rehashing and rehashing and beating a dead horse that's not going to make the progress that, it's needed to be made.
You have such a fascinating journey. I'm really enjoying hearing all the components and all the different obstacles that you've really overcome, and you're really giving back to your community, which is so amazing. Okay, you had mentioned to me as well that you are a yoga instructor.
Yoga therapist.
Okay, a yoga therapist. So tell us a little bit about it, and why would someone want to learn yoga, and what are the benefits of it?
So first off, I want to make the distinction between a yoga instructor and a yoga therapist, because most people do not know the difference in my experience. So yoga certification is divided into two primary levels. You have your RYT 200, which, well, RYT is your registered yoga teacher. So the 200-hour registration is for individuals who can study yoga for 200 clock hours. Includes anatomy, physiology, of course, the teaching of yoga and basic poses and breath work, and qualifies you to teach a group class. The 500-hour level expands on that immensely. You get another 300 hours of instruction. You do more of a deep dive into the anatomy of yoga, how to work with individuals who may have bad back or bad hip that make certain poses difficult, how to do adaptations. Of course, you do a deep dive into philosophy more, and you work more on how to teach individuals rather than group work. So the yoga therapist level is another anywhere from 800 to 1500 hours of training on top of the RYT 500. This is essentially it's medical yoga. So we learn pathophysiology, biochemistry, psychology, surgical techniques. I could go on and on, talk about competencies all day, but essentially we're medical providers and we learn how to apply yogic principles to the treatment of, like, say, sciatica, orthopedic concerns, surgery recovery, balance conditions, and even yogic counseling for individuals with psychological concerns.
Wow. And why would somebody seek out yoga over any other kind of therapy?
So, generally speaking, the individual seeking out yoga therapy want that holistic approach rather than the clinical model.
What is that? What is that holistic approach? Like, what is the idea behind yoga?
So yoga is divided into eight different limbs. So we can make like lifestyle recommendations, teach meditation, do some work with nutrition. So rather than just like pathologizing a clinical concern, we might explore, okay, like what does your diet look like? And if someone tells me, okay, they're eating chips all day, first thing I'm going to do is explore what nutrition, proper nutrition looks like, specifically from a yogic lens. So yoga therapy specifically pulls from something called Ayurveda, which is the traditional Indian system of medicine. And that is based on, it classifies you into one of three body types, essentially. And we look at food as either being good for you or harmful. So I will teach, okay, yoga and Ayurveda views, let's say, chocolate chip cookies is harmful, but views of salads is good for you. And then generally, once we've classified their preferred foods, it starts to like really click for them. Like, okay, if I start eating more good foods, my body's not going to hate me. I'm not going to have these GI issues or whatever is coming up for them.
Wow. I like that holistic view of like looking at all the different components.
And we might also include spending more time in nature and in the treatment plan, morning yoga.
What is the benefit of spending more time with nature? Why would you suggest that?
So, as an example, vitamin D deficiency can cause depression. And one of the only way, there's two ways to get vitamin D: sun exposure and what I like to call horse pills. So, if you can get someone, out in nature more and get them exposed to more sunlight, we can see a natural reduction in mild to moderate depression. It's not always perfect by any means, but most of my individuals that have tried it have noticed a fairly substantial difference.
How much time are you suggesting that people go out be with sun exposure a day in order to like really combat it?
Anywhere from 15 to 30 minutes on average, just daily. So, just like myself, I live across from a like a bike trail. So my morning ritual is just going out in the morning, walking the trail, then coming back, and that gets me my daily sun exposure.
Okay, so you're not suggesting a crazy amount, though. That's something that I think everyone could incorporate into their day.
Yeah, like I'm not suggesting anyone start tanning or anything of the sort.
Okay. What other components are you looking at in yoga?
So the physiological components. So in yoga, the Sanskrit word for poses is called asana, and each asana has a very specific purpose when used to the yoga therapy lens. So, for example, some poses are more stimulating, whereas other poses are calming and relaxing. So if I find that someone, we'll just use the depression example. If someone is depressed, I might prescribe poses that are more stimulating for the body to help really ignite the nervous system. Whereas if someone is, let's say, on the spectrum, we'd want to look at more calming poses and different forms of meditation. So, for example, movement therapy is very helpful for neurodivergent individuals, particularly individuals with ADHD, because they cannot sit there and meditate. It's next to impossible. But what I will do in that case is prescribe like walking as meditation. So, like, I have an individual with a plant special interest. So, once week she goes into DC to the botanical garden and goes through a walk through their little like facility, so she gets exposure to her special interest and gets movement meditation.
Wow, I love how you're incorporating special interests into your therapy because it just makes it so much more realistic and exciting for the individual.
And I find that if you find something, I think it's naturally reinforcing for the individual. They're far more likely to give you that buy-in than if you try to pigeonhole them.
Yeah, that's for sure. But I love how you I hear it in our whole talk today. You really very much incorporate special interest. Okay, so let's go back to yoga. So we have the positions, and that, like, how long does it take to teach individuals to hold the positions and to implement them?
For the simple ones, I can do it in about a, really an hour. For individuals with like balance issues or individuals that want to learn the more advanced poses, that takes months. Everything builds in it on itself. So for example, there is a pose called Preparation for Warrior Three, also known as Sunbird. So for that, what you do is you get on your hands and knees and extend your left arm out along with your right leg. What that's doing is strengthening the core muscles and helping with balance. So for Warrior Three, what you're doing is balancing on one leg. So basically, you're using your left leg to support yourself, and you're extending your entire body and having your arm and leg extended while balancing on one foot. So you cannot just jump straight to doing that if you've never done yoga in your life.
So it's a buildup of the core muscles as well.
Yes, so you're getting physiological benefit as well as psychological.
Wow. Wow. And tell us a little bit about the breathing. I know breathing is big in yoga.
Yes, so the term we use in yoga for the breath work is pranayama. Prana is a word in Sanskrit meaning like life force, and yama refers to like a practice or breath, depending on, you know, context. So the Hindu belief is that when you do the breathing practices, you're affecting your prana or your life force. It's similar to the concept of like qi in qigong or various other spiritual practices. What's actually happening physiologically is when you do like a calming breath, you're increasing the oxygenation in the brain, and that in turn naturally activates the parasympathetic nervous system or the PNS. So what the parasympathetic nervous system is a secondary nervous system that returns the body to homeostasis. So when you do the breath work properly, you're telling the PNS that it needs to activate. That in turn will modulate and calm down the central nervous system. And with individuals with autism, like I said, with the increased synaptic connections and the hyperactivity of the nervous system, this becomes like paramount for them to stay regulated in situations when they might not be able to stim. I make the analogy I give to like a benzodiazepine. It's very quick acting and good for emergency situations.
Wow. Yeah, I'm sure breath work could be really good in calming individuals down when they're in a very anxiety provoking situation or an uncomfortable situation.
Yes, and it works wonders for most people.
And it's something you don't need to bring along with you. You just have it within you, so you could really like tap into it at all times of day.
Yes, you got a set of lungs, so as long as you don't have underlying pulmonary issues that contraindicate, you can take it with you anywhere.
Yeah, that's a really great tool to be able to teach individuals. What are, let's say, the first one or two steps that you're teaching somebody when you're teaching them to breathe?
So I break it down step by step. The first technique I always teach is called the 4-8-8 technique. So that is where you inhale through the nose for 4 seconds. You hold it for 8 seconds. Then you slowly exhale through the mouth for 8 seconds. Yeah, it takes time to get it.
Yeah, to get it. Okay, and then following the 4-8-8, what's next?
So if someone needs something that's more stimulating, there's something called skull shining breath, which I'm not going to teach today because it essentially can induce hyperventilation. And I don't want to see you.
You don't want to see me hyperventilate. No, that would be a really fun podcast, though. You'll be the first one to get me to hyperventilate.
It's first time for everything. There's also something called bumblebee breath, which is, again, like rapid fire breathing combined with humming. And that is, again, more of a stimulating breath work. But what I teach depends on what I'm trying to accomplish. So if skull shining would be more to get someone more invigorated and to activate the nervous system, bumblebee or the 4-8-8 technique would be more of a calming, self-regulation.
Wow, fascinating. Fascinating. So, really, yoga is a nice thing for individuals to be able to tap into if they're looking for a holistic approach in regulating their system, but really it's their whole life because it seems like we look at all different parts of an individual. I love that we're looking at how we're spending our day, how we're eating, how we're breathing, how our physical body is reacting to the environment and being able to move throughout the day. So yoga really has a lot of benefits.
Yes, it r really does, and I wish more practitioners would recommend it.
Yeah, I think Western culture, we don't tap into it as much as Eastern culture. Am I correct?
That's correct. Over in India, for example, yoga therapists are considered to be licensed doctors. It's like you are considered to be holding a medical license, whereas over here in the West, it's, just shoved away as just relaxation or stretching.
Right. And why do you think that is?
I have a few theories, but primarily I think that the way Western medicine works, doctors are more inclined to prescribe a pill or a quick fix, whereas with yoga, you're addressing the root of the problem. In most cases, so that in turn takes away the reliance on medication.
Oh. So pretty much. You think that in America we're pushing a lot of medication and we're not choosing to explore the other options, which might be the healthier and better option.
Yes, I see many cases, even in my personal life, of going to doctors and they're prescribing tests I know are absolutely unnecessary or trying to just prescribe a medication as a quick fix rather than a more holistic or even realistic solution.
Well, Matthew, you have given us such a breadth of information today. I feel like I could just keep going and delving more. You have so you're just a world of knowledge. Thank you for sharing all your thoughts, insight, personal obstacles and being able to overcome them. You're a real inspiration to the entire neurodivergent community. And thank you for coming on and joining us today.
Very welcome. It was a pleasure to be here.